It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studio once again, Jov Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. We were right in sync that time.
Yeah, that was kind of creepy, actually.
For the first time.
Pretty busy week there in the papers covering what's going on the other side of the world.
Yeah, I have to say, I just got back last night after having been in Vancouver, BC for the last 3 days, and boy, the media is a lot different there. You actually get coverage of what's going on the other side of the world as opposed to stand-ups in front of the Pentagon, with the U.S. officials describing what they think is going on the other side of the world, you know, like remnants here and there.
And completely minimizing it.
And completely minimizing it or just not talking about it at all in the case of Afghanistan. There's just been very, very little here. But if you go north of the border or if you tune into British press or go online and read some of the European or Islamic world press, it's been a very, very different story this week.
Mm. So let's dive into that, starting with Afghanistan.
Yes, our other war over there in the Middle East is what's going on in Afghanistan. There was some major news from Afghanistan this past week.
Yeah, it was actually fell apart in just as significant a way as Iraq did this week, but didn't really get into the news that much.
That's right. General Rashid Dostum, one of the major warlords who was an ally of the U.S. when we invaded Afghanistan.
And who before that had a rich tradition of mass murder, rape, torture, etc.
Yes,
as a member of the Northern Alliance and the ruling government in the 90s.
Yes, a very large and long and very ugly human rights record. General Rashid Dostum controls the northern, I would say almost a third of the country in northern Afghanistan. And this week he expanded his territory quite a bit. In addition to holding the major city of Mazar-e-Sharif, he moved into two additional provinces, driving out the governors who had been appointed by President Hamid Karzai. And those governors have appealed to Hamid Karzai, please send us some troops to help defend our provinces. And, of course, there are no troops to send.
Yeah, they sent a few hundred members of the newly constituted ANA, which is the national army that the U.S. is trying to train there.
Yeah, and there's some question as to whether those guys will actually fight Dostum's troops for the same reason that we'll talk about later with the problems that the U.S. is having with Iraqi police and militia in Iraq. They're having some of the same problems with the new Afghan army. Some of those guys go in for training. They take the courses, they get the weapons, they get the uniforms, and then they go home and they don't stay and do their duty as a new member of the new military. And of course, when they're deployed to fight against some of their friends and family members and tribal relations in certain parts of the country, they will just refuse.
Or they can be bought over to the other side very easily, too. That also happens quite a bit.
Yes, a lot of them will say, well, God, I'm not making very much, not getting paid very much as a member of the new Afghan army. However, General Dostum over here, he'll pay me, you know, three times that amount to join his group.
Because of all the money he's making from
from the opium trade. Yes, that was the other news in Afghanistan this week, is that the UN said, look, the opium trade in Afghanistan last year, they produced somewhere around 4,000 tons of opium, which is about three-fourths of the world's total supply. Now, it's starting to account for more than half of Afghanistan's national income in the opium trade. And that's a severe problem, especially when you look at not just financing these regional warlords like Ismail Khan in the west of the country. He controls another large portion of Afghanistan, which is also outside of the control of Hamid Karzai and Kabul and the U.S., and Rashid Dostum in the north, but it also is fueling discontent within Hamid Karzai's government. A lot of corruption going on there, and even members of his cabinet who are taking payments from opium traffickers as well.
Yeah. So the latest this morning on the two provinces where Dostum's folks had taken over yesterday is that the ANA is reportedly anyway back in control in one of the cities,
The Afghan National Army.
Yeah, the Afghan National Army. Maimani, I believe, is mm-hmm. how it's pronounced. But they're supposedly back there and won, but it wasn't clear whether they were going to stay or not, and it certainly wasn't clear whether the governor was going to return to his post or not. And meanwhile, Dostum, who is complaining about U.S. overflights of his house and complaining that he wasn't consulted by Karzai. Now, it was fascinating in the New York Times account this morning where they're describing Dostum. First of all, he's a renegade. He's not a warlord. He's not a horrific abuser of human rights. But also that he's described as a frequent advocate of Afghanistan's central government. Well, not exactly. What has happened is that Dostum was invited to participate in the Loya Jirga, even though he and the other warlords were not supposed to, by the United States. They sort of roped him in because the United States has been willing to deal with these kind of guys.
And they were worried about an immediate civil war.
And they were worried about an immediate civil war. So what happens is that you have essentially the third of the country that Dostum controls is essentially the payoff for his not directly challenging the central government. And what has happened this week is this is sort of a probing action where he's not only trying to expand his own territory in the immediate sense, but he's also trying to probe the strength of the central government to find out whether the United States will back it up at a time when it has its hands full in Iraq and at a time politically where it's not going to make a major new commitment to Afghanistan with a political election looming.
That's exactly right.
All right. Anything else on Afghanistan?
No, the only other thing we probably should mention is that they were going to get elections started this summer in Afghanistan, and those have been postponed until September or October or, well, whenever, I guess, whenever they actually get around to registering people. So far, the UN, because most areas outside of the capital city of Kabul are no-go areas for aid workers and UN personnel, the UN has only been able to register about 10 to 20% of the adult population.
And almost all of that is in Kabul.
Almost all of that is in Kabul and surrounding neighborhoods, and almost none of it is in the countryside.
All right. Well, then let's move over to Iraq, where it's been a very busy week, obviously.
Yes, folks might want to
Iraq.
No.
Just to give you the idea that you're going to have heard all this before, since as I recall, we were talking in the what was it? It was a year ago today, in fact, that the U.S. troops came into Baghdad, and we were talking during the invasion about how you could tell from the reaction of Iraqis to the U.S. troops that it wasn't this sort of massive, oh, we're so grateful to have you here type reaction that it was supposed to be, according to Pentagon spinmeisters, that, you know, in a sense, you could tell that this war was lost, that narrative was inaccurate, and because of that, sooner or later, the U.S. is going to be driven out of Iraq. The only question was how long and how long it would take, and, here we are a year later.
Yeah, no, I think it's quite clear what we have going on in Iraq is largely a progression from when the first U.S. tanks rolled across the border into the country. You had the beginnings of an occupation, and an occupation always brings a group of people who will say, look, you know, we have to resist the occupation. So yeah. Occupation will always bring resistance.
And it always brings within the occupier propaganda that basically says, well, we're doing this in the best interests of the people who are occupied. And that's what we've been getting from the White House for the last year, is we're doing this in their interests and the natives are ever so grateful.
That's simply not true. No, and the interesting thing is, too, that all along the way, in addition to the actual invasion itself, the U.S. has made some very, very significant mistakes, the largest one replacing General Jay Garner with Paul Bremer and his first
Bremer's been a disaster.
Yeah, and his first two acts when he became, you know, the U.S.'s viceroy over there was to disband the Iraqi army and send home all of these guys with their weapons and their training and tell them that we're not going to pay you anymore, you don't have a way to make a living, and you and your family can starve. And that basically just set up a whole new army to fight the U.S. when these guys got together and decided, well, we can't have this. We're going to drive the U.S. out. And his other major big mistake was to stop elections.
Yeah, which was why Garner was replaced in the first place, because
right.
he had won the elections.
Right, and we had this week some British officers high up in the British military saying, look, we had told Donald Rumsfeld and we had told Paul Bremer in the beginning that you can't disband the Iraqi army and you have to have elections as soon as possible or else there are going to be major problems. So it wasn't just Jay Garner who was telling them that. It was also guys high up in the British military, sort of the equivalent of our Joint Chiefs of Staff, who were saying the same thing.
And it was history and it was common sense also, I think.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, as far as the Shiites are concerned, Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell have been spending a lot of time this week trying to reassure Congress and the American people and the U.S. press that, gosh, no, it's not a major Shiite uprising. It's only a few hundred guys. It's just this one radical cleric and his followers.
Which is basically being written. I just have to say that hearing that from Canada, the reaction there, both among people I was talking to and in the media, has just been nothing short of derisive laughter.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not taken seriously.
Yeah, because if you actually see some of the footage of what's going on there, or you read you read the reports from the reporters who are in these cities where the uprising is occurring, places like Najaf and Karbala, Baghdad, there are large portions of the capital city where the U.S. military simply cannot go, particularly at night, and they've lost control of certain parts of the capital city. Places like Nasiriya and Amara and also some Sunni areas of the country as well. If you read the press from hot off the wire services or the European press or the Arab media of any kind, what you find is a much, much wider revolt going on. And it's not just this radical cleric Muqtada al-Sadr and his militia. He's also getting some cooperation from the Badr Brigades. That's the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Those guys are also cooperating with them. And there are just a ton of ordinary Iraqi Shiites who are going to the offices of Muqtada al-Sadr in the various cities in southern Iraq, and they're saying we want to volunteer.
Where do I sign up? Yeah. It's really been remarkable. I saw a couple of really telling quotes in the Canadian media this past week about both Sunnis and Shiites saying, you know, we have to thank George Bush for one thing. He has brought this country together in a way that nothing else in memory has. You've got Shiites, you've got Sunnis, you've got these different religious factions within those two major branches, all cooperating, all aiding one another, aiding in trying to break the siege in Fallujah, mm-hmm. aiding in not only providing support to Muqtada's militias, but just spontaneous uprisings in cities across Iraq that aren't connected necessarily to any militias that anybody knew about, you know, before 3 days ago.
Right. And one of the ways that the U.S. has done that is the response to the initial demonstrations held by Muqtada al-Sadr and his group in Baghdad. Now, the seed that started the current uprising was planted last week when the U.S. closed down the newspaper of Muqtada al-Sadr and his group.
Yeah, Al-Hawza.
Yeah, saying that it was sparking violence when, in fact, there really was not much evidence that Paul Bremer had cited of lies that were being printed by that newspaper in particular that had cited any particular acts of violence. And that started up some major street demonstrations in Baghdad, at least, last week. Now, that was followed by, over the weekend, the U.S. had arrested a major top aide of Muqtada al-Sadr.
And declared al-Sadr himself an outlaw.
Yeah, and issued a warrant for his arrest. Now, what happened was in Baghdad, in Sadr City, a large Shiite slum, which is how it's usually described. In other words, it's a poor neighborhood with lots and lots of people living in it, and they're mostly Shiites. In Sadr City, a lot of people turned out to protest this because that's the main base of his support in the capital. And the U.S. met these protesters, some of whom were carrying guns and were firing their weapons in the air, which is very common for people to do in the Middle East. The U.S. Military responded by sending in Apache helicopter gunships and firing on demonstrators, killing somewhere around 69 to 70 people and wounding almost 300. Now, that got a lot of airplay, not just in Iraq, but all over the Arab world.
But not here.
But not here, of course. And what that did is that sparked a lot of these uprisings in these other Shiite cities saying, God, now they're shooting our people. What is going on? And a lot of the wounded and the dead were women and children and people who were obviously innocent civilians. Now, at the same time, you had the U.S. surrounding the city of Fallujah and carrying out what is obviously a collective revengeful punishment for the death of those four American contractors. And that in itself is a crime under international law, to carry out a collective punishment against a whole city or a whole group of people for the crimes of a few. And you have to understand that Fallujah is a city with no infrastructure. There's no electricity there, no water service. There's very little for the residents who have lived there, because the U.S. has viewed it as the major battleground in Iraq. And instead of saying, well, if we restored the electricity and maybe people there wouldn't resent us so much, the U.S. military just responded with continual poundings and aggression, house-to-house searches.
Yeah,
that sort of thing.
And the issue with collective punishment is also really a very sensitive one for another reason, or one that was a really a tactical mistake for another reason, which is that in the Middle East and in Iraq, it is also associated with the primary form of aggression that Israel has used for years and years and years against Palestinians, is collective punishment for the sins of a few. This is what bulldozing all the homes in the West Bank and Gaza is about. This is, you know, the uprooting of the olive trees, the shelling of different Palestinian cities and refugee camps,
destroying the center of certain refugee camps.
Yeah, this is something that has been widely publicized throughout the Arab world for many years as a crime against humanity, and the U.S. has been seen as complicit in this. When the U.S. is doing the same type of collective punishment against Iraqis in Fallujah, what that says to Iraqis across the country is, we're going to meet the same fate as Palestinians. And in fact, you're starting to see in the last couple of days Iraqis calling this uprising an intifada. Mm-hmm. They're giving it the same name that the Palestinian struggle is, and linking the Iraqi uprising with the fate of the Palestinians, which is, you know, just the nightmare scenario as far as the Bush administration could be concerned.
Yeah, and so by doing the same thing to both the Shiites and to the Sunnis in Iraq at the same time, we're actually driving them together in resistance against the U.S. troops. Now, the other thing that's going on, too, that we've talked a little bit about on this show in past weeks is that the U.S. has been refusing to organize elections and to move forward in the whole electoral and democratic process, primarily because they were worried that Shiite fundamentalists would come to power through elections. Now, anyone who's been paying attention to the small local elections in towns and villages in southern Iraq knows that that is absolutely not the case. That's not what's going on in these small local town council elections. You have the Muslim fundamentalists, some of whom were put in place by U.S. troops as they moved through some of these towns and villages, because they were viewed as guys who had an organization in place and could keep the peace. Those guys are being replaced by people who are elected, who are school teachers, businessmen, you know, former politicians, maybe some of them under the Ba'ath Party, but people who have some experience and are secular politicians, not religious figures. And so the U.S. has been delaying elections for a phony reason. Now, in addition, the U.S. has refused to negotiate or address the concerns of Ayatollah al-Sistani, a moderate Shiite cleric who has no interest in becoming a political leader in Iraq. And because they haven't been dealing with al-Sistani's, the issues that he's brought up,
he is by far the most influential cleric in Iraq.
Yes, they're now forced to deal with a far more radical figure, Muqtada al-Sadr. So it's really a situation where the U.S. has made a lot of missteps along the way by fearing bringing democracy to Iraq, and by holding it off in order to keep control. We've actually sparked this enormous insurgency now.
And the question then becomes, and this is something that that Maria, that you and I haven't really had a chance to talk about since I've been out of town, and so we didn't talk about it before we went on the air, but the question then comes, what comes next? Where does this go?
That's right. Now, the Bush administration keeps pointing out that the way to deal with this is with more, you know, bombs and to train more and more Iraqi troops for a new Iraqi army and more Iraqi police, etc. Now, I want to point out one other scary detail that's been going on this week is that a lot of the Iraqi police and militia men have not been fighting against the Shiite militia uprising. What they've been doing is they've either been standing aside in the best scenarios, they've just been stepping aside. In the worst scenarios, U.S. troops are reporting that Iraqi policemen will turn around and turn their guns on U.S. troops and fight alongside the Shiite militia men.
And an awful lot of the cases also, they're getting the weapons and the uniforms and the cars
In some cities, in some places like Karbala and Najaf and in portions of Baghdad, the Iraqi police who have stepped aside have let Shiite militiamen take control of police stations where they have access to police weapons, police uniforms, bulletproof vests, police vehicles, and they've been redistributing those to Shiite militiamen. So now, in the future, it's going to be really, really hard to tell who is an Iraqi policeman and who is not. You know, more so than it already is, with some evidence coming out this week that it was Iraqi Civilian Defense Corps, the Iraqi paramilitaries, who led those four Americans into an ambush inside Fallujah.
And I think there also is really a question. I mean, we've talked a lot about sort of the political miscalculations and the miscalculations of the occupation, but there's also a tremendous military miscalculation here that the United States is trying to, you know, do this iron fist kind of a policy, but they're trying to do it with far fewer troops than would be necessary for that kind of a policy to be effective. That there's been this sort of artificial ceiling on the number of troops that have been in Iraq that the Joint Chiefs have been complaining about, saying that, you know, in order to do what you want us to do, we need 500,000 troops. And Rumsfeld in particular has been adamant about trying to rotate troops out, about
it has
not
to be
not
as
having,
low as 100,000.
Yeah, And this is for political reasons. This is because of the upcoming American election, and it's been a setup for exactly the kind of chaos where we're seeing, where you've got troops that are exhausted. You've got National Guardsmen on the front lines now who have had less than a month of training, who have inadequate supplies for this type of warfare, certainly never expected to find themselves in this kind of a situation. You know, there have been some real serious miscalculations by our wartime president in terms of how the war itself has been waged.
Yeah, and as far as U.S. troops are concerned and coalition troops, I want to say two things. One is, if you have a teenage son or daughter, you should probably get them a passport, because I can see a draft coming somewhere down the road. And I say that not because I'm thinking George Bush will win the election, but I'm saying that because it's also Democrats in Congress who are saying, yeah, we need more troops in Iraq. So that's obviously what we're marching towards here in the U.S., is this notion that we need to put more U.S. troops over there. Where are we going to get them? We don't have them. We're going to probably have to do something akin to a draft.
Yeah, and you've got both John Kerry and George Bush are committed at this point to keeping U.S. troops in Iraq. And, you know, really the only way that scenario would not continue to take place is if the U.S. simply gets routed, and there's probably too much firepower for that to happen. So I think the near-term scenario, there's not very much promising that's unfolding there right now. It looks like it could get fairly ugly.
And the other thing I want to say is about coalition troops. Currently, our current coalition partners are rethinking whether or not they want to redeploy new troops to replace the ones that they have in there when their time is up. The Bush administration and a lot of Democrats in Congress are also talking about, well, we got to bring the UN, we got to have UN peacekeepers in there, et cetera, et cetera. However, other UN or NATO countries, NATO is another option that's been cited, they're stretched pretty thin too with peacekeeping duties elsewhere around the world. A lot of the countries that could help us, France and Germany, for example, did not sign on to the war to begin with, and they're just probably going to laugh us off the world stage if we ask them at this point, now that everything has blown up in the way that it has.
Yeah, and you've also got something of a political crisis that's happening now in Japan that's been triggered by the kidnapping of the three Japanese civilians in Iraq,
mm-hmm,
where you've got demonstrations. And street demonstrations in East Asian countries are a very unusual phenomenon. It's not something that happens a lot. You had a couple different demonstrations of thousands of people in Tokyo yesterday. yesterday protesting Prime Minister Koizumi, who, similar to Aznar in Spain, really went out on a limb against public opinion by committing Japanese troops against the constitution of Japan to the coalition effort. And, you know, the public response there is now this is seeing this is what happens. This is what Japan is being targeted as well. This is something that, you know, prime ministers and leaders of countries throughout the world are saying is that if you ally yourself with the U.S. on this, you're going to endanger yourselves politically. And it's really undermining, I think, the potential for the U.S. to get any kind of help from other international bodies or international allies.
Yes, I would agree with that.
We only have a few minutes left, and I actually want to get back to a point or a question you had raised there, Jav, in the few minutes, talking about the U.S., our solution there seems to be military. You know, if it's like for whatever's happening, we just ratchet it up. We'll just put in more troops or, you know, use bigger bombs, more hits. Do you think that there's any real chance of going towards, you know, getting a vote in there and doing a diplomatic solution there? And how would that come about?
I don't see that happening for at least months, maybe not years down the road.
I don't either. Particularly with the Bush administration, you know, if you have Kerry in power, you know, perhaps by this time next year, you could have some sort of a diplomatic solution. You know, if we learned anything from Vietnam, what we learned was when the indigenous population does not want you there, you can kill 20 times as many, and we did in Southeast Asia. We killed 2 million people of theirs. They killed 50,000 of ours, which is, you know, if you want to divide it out, that's 7 or 8 years of 20 soldiers a day dying. You know, you can kill as many of quote unquote them as you possibly can, and you can have as much firepower as you can possibly have. You're still not going to win because it's still their country, and it raises the question politically of what is our objective in Iraq? Why are we there? Are we there to impose a democracy on a people who don't want us there, and certainly aren't going to want our political system if they don't want us?
And have seen our pretty pathetic efforts so far at a democracy in Iraq is laughable.
Yeah, they've. I mean, you know, the emerging consensus in Iraq right now is that the U.S. in what it has done has been a worse experience than Saddam Hussein has been. That you have had both the repression that went with Saddam Hussein, the things like closing down of newspapers and declaring of dissidents as outlaws and issuing arrest warrants and lack of judicial system.
Yeah, I think more commonly the U.S. Occupation is being seen as a continuation of the Saddam era.
Yeah, I think that's true too. But you have not only that, but then you also additionally have the incompetence in the administration with the lack of basic services, the disaster that is the economy,
which makes
all
them
the
worse
rest of
than
that.
Saddam.
Yeah. which is what makes it worse. But yes, I agree. It is seen because people do remember Saddam as having been, and the Baathists as having been originally a creature of the United States, and the United States having done a lot to keep them empowered in the first decade or so that they were there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're pretty much out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found around town in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places that carry free publications. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, or you want to donate, you can give us a call at 206-903-9461.
People can always get subscriptions.
Yeah. That's right.
And we'll be back with more good news every other week in the paper and next week here on the radio.
That's right.